is a production of Cornell University.
Good evening, everyone. It's 4:34 on October 7th, and I'd like to call this meeting of the University Assembly to order. Thank you for coming. Are there any late additions to the agenda? Mr. Battaglia.
We have a draft of Resolution 2, a resolution formally welcoming President Elizabeth Garrett to Cornell and inviting her to participate in shared governance in the way that President Scorton has.
Thank you. Are there any objections to adding that to the agenda? Hearing none, we will add that to the agenda. Are there any other late additions? Thank you, then. Next is the minutes from the last meeting. They were sent around to members ahead of time. Do I have a motion to pass the minutes?
I make a motion.
By Ms. Odessa. Second?
Second.
By Mr. Battaglia. Discussion. Are there any changes or updates to the minutes? Hearing none, I ask your unanimous consent to pass the minutes of September 9th, 2014, as presented. Are there any objections? Hearing none, the minutes are approved or adopted. Next, reports from the assemblies. First up, the student assembly, Ms. Spalik.
Hello, everyone.
Hi.
The student assembly is busy as usual. recently, we passed a couple of resolutions about trying out new parking solutions in College Town. We're also working on having our UA representatives, that are students but are not elected to the student assembly, sit as ex officio members on the assembly. And other than that, we'll have a lot of stuff coming up. I'm expecting the next few weeks to be very busy. We have some brainstorming sessions, and I think we'll definitely have a lot
coming up. Awesome. Are there any questions for Ms. Bailey? Thank you. GPSA, Mr. Walworth.
So, GPSA is, last night, we passed our own resolution welcoming the newly elected president to Cornell and inviting her to participate in shared governance. We also invited her to address our assembly at least once per semester, the same way that President Scorton would address us. Aside from that, we've heard from Dean Newt about the new procedures for graduate student injuries pertaining to a resolution we passed last year, which asked for workers' compensation benefits for graduate students. They have addressed that, and now the procedure will be to go to the Workers' Compensation Board of the State of New York for a decision on workers' compensation on a case-by-case basis.
Is that acceptable to the GPSA? Is that what you wanted?
We would have preferred that Cornell recognize our right to workers' compensation. As it stands, there are some ambiguities in the procedures, such as only in the case of an hourly appointment or an assistantship would workers' compensation be would the review be automatically triggered by the board. If someone won a fellowship or injured not in the performance of their assistantship duties, then that would not automatically qualify, and it would be up to the student to appeal. So there are some things which we're not 100% happy with, but overall we think that they've done a very good job of addressing our concerns, and at least outline the procedures very nicely so that there's all the information is codified in one place and there's no need to go looking throughout the various websites. So.
Excellent. Yes.
And also, I don't think any of my other fellow representatives are here, but we did elect a new University Assembly representative, Tasia, who is not here, unfortunately. I can't point him out.
Hopefully he'll come in later. I met Tasia, very engaging and very engaged. I think he'll be a fine addition to the main body of the Assembly.
Oh, One other point I did want to bring up, we were also addressed by someone from the mayor's office of the city of Ithaca talking about a proposed change to the odd even parking plan, which might get rolled out next year, where instead of it being an odd even system, they would shut down a section of street at a time, which would work out to be about a fifth of the city's parking spaces being shut down as opposed to half every day. So that's something that might get rolled out next year, something to keep an eye out for. Yeah, which they also address the FAA.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Walrus? Employee Assembly, Mr. Meese.
So just so everybody knows, we have our president's address to staff coming up October 28th from 12 to 1 in Bailey Hall. It's a 30-minute or so address from the president to the staff with some Q&A time as well. This will be his, it won't be the last time he addresses the staff, but it will be his last address to staff. So we're excited for that and expecting a good turnout. At the EA, we've been meeting with Paul Bursick from the benefits office to get an update about that. Nothing major to report. We've also been going through some rebranding, understanding who it is and what it is that we do. So we recently passed a resolution that solidified a mission and vision statement for us, as well as some brand objectives.
Us being the EA?
The EA, yeah.
Sorry.
So that's what we've sort of been focusing on. We also have our next meeting is with Dan Roth, less of an information session, but more of a roundtable discussion on how the EA and employees can do their part to a more sustainable campus, and what actions we can work with their office on to actually implement some micro changes around campus.
Awesome. Questions for Mr. Meese? Thank you. Dean Burns, Faculty Senate.
I'll talk a little bit about the past and a little bit about the future. In the past, our September meeting, we had a report from Dan Roth with Dan Roth's group. So I've seen that about three times. I think that was enough for me. We had a forum, a faculty forum, on international programs and practices. This is to look at the 170-odd memoranda of understanding that Cornell has with other universities and institutions abroad. That includes some of the most noble things that Cornell does, but also some of the most questionable things that Cornell does. And so it was a very interesting forum in Statler Auditorium with more than 100 faculty there, plus others. We will be hearing tomorrow at our Senate meeting a report on the plans for the Tuscaloosa Centennial. A major part of that will be here at Cornell for the entire community, the students, the staff, the faculty, on the last weekend in April, including an academic procession on Monday morning, and that will close the university classes to be off on Monday morning, April 27th. We will also hear a presentation from Vice President Paul Streeter about the budget and planning and budget planning. Things that I will tell my senators tomorrow about include that we, in the spring, we introduced a new title, academic title, Professor of Practice. We now have our first application for such a professor of practice in the College of Human Ecology, and that will go through the Senate, presumably. I'll talk to them a little bit about the presidential search on that committee, and we'll also be starting to address, as you must have proposed, the new policy that all business matters must be ended by 5 o'clock, and that means that people would like our Senate meeting to change the time.
Okay, that last part, I guess I've not seen anything on that.
We're being told basically we must move our Senate meeting.
By whom?
All departmental. The provost and the senior vice provost.
It was our understanding that 4:30 to 6 is the blackout period for the, in other words, for things like extracurricular meetings like this, which are not department meetings. So I don't know whether we fall in this or not.
I hear Jim, and I think the very reasonable one is that the university would like to see all segments of the university be involved in governance matters.
Mm-hmm.
and leadership matters, and if we have meetings that run until 6 o'clock, you're sort of wiping out young families and parents. And so we need to meet. And there seemed to be strong support on the UFC for doing something, but what the hell is going to do, we don't know.
Yeah, the problem for us has been, it would be a boon for our employee in general, or employee participation, but it becomes, the earlier in the day it gets, it really interferes with faculty and student.
And you got a lot of faculty on the faculty
senate. So we'll look into that, see whether it applies to us, and then if it does, how to respond to it. And I guess I would ask the Office of Assemblies to help us with that. I know, but I bet you caught your attention, right? As we're booked for the rest of this semester, and next month they're going to be booking us for next semester. So I guess very timely. Coming back to Professor of Profession?
Professor of the Practice.
Professor of the Practice, pardon me. What is that?
It's a track like the Clinical Professor, which is a non-tenured track for primarily teaching faculty who are showing things, and that was very appropriate for people in the best college who were, you know, showing how to do this operation or that operation, or people in the law school who were showing how to do the following things in legal practice. But the title sounded a little weird if you were in the business school and you wanted somebody from the outside, or if you were in computer science and you wanted Bill Gates to come and be a professor, you want to call them a clinical professor. And there are quite stringent requirements on that. And this, so they think like there can only be a certain fraction of the tenure track faculty. They can't participate in the following things. They can't do much teaching or not much research. Stuff like that.
They would, however,
are now considering also expected to come in front of the Senate a new title for research professor, which would be another side effect.
And they would be part of the faculty, so they don't fall into this place where we have groups of like senior research associates, where it's, are they employees, are they faculty?
They would be much closer to faculty.
Okay.
But not.
Thank you. Questions for Dean Burns? Thank you, sir. Executive Committee, Mr. Battaglia.
Yes, most important to note is President Scorton will be at our next meeting. We traditionally have three topics of general topics we bring to him. Right now, we have TCAT is the first and foremost, as you all should be aware. The university reached a memorandum of understanding with the TCAT board. The details should be coming out this Thursday or hopefully before the weekend. So we would like you to survey your constituencies to figure out if anything specific that's pressing that you'd like to be brought before President Scorton. I have heard some information that also that the moving up of carbon neutrality to 2035 might be brought forward because there's some internal issues of whether or not that is going to actually happen. Additionally, that will be the third slot available. Also, we had our first committee meetings 2 weeks ago. They went very well. There was a member of the UA exec at every committee meeting. Also, in terms of vacancies, we are currently looking at the CIC, one member from the GPSA, one member from the SA, and then one member directly from the GPSA. On the CWC, we're looking at one member by the Faculty Senate, one member from the Faculty Senate, and then one also from and by, one each, pardon me, for the GPSA.
Yeah, those are vacancies, and we have two, correct me, Professor Wong, vacancies on, Professor Wayne, on the CJC, is that correct?
Two vacancies, one faculty, one faculty.
My compliments both to Dean Burns and to Marty Hatch. We went from having really no faculty on the standing committees to filling at least half the void. Thank you. Still some work to be done, but I really appreciate getting that perspective onto these committees. And I know that the GPSA is working their slots, and I appreciate that. Other things from the...
I believe that sums it up.
I will send out an email to everybody asking if there's topics you want us to ask President Scorton to address. As Mr. Battaglia said, we will be asking a little bit more about TCAT itself and perhaps carbon neutrality. But when I see what your concerns are, we'll send out and work through what we ask him to address with us. He generally takes about 30 minutes plus Q&A. I expect he'll arrive about 5 o'clock. But he gets here when he gets here. We generally suspend the agenda, turn to him, and then pick it back up where he, whenever he has to depart or there's nothing else left to investigate. So, thank you. Campus Infrastructure Committee, Mr. Lucelle.
We met on the 23rd. It's a preliminary review of last year's activities. We elected Ellis and Alex, the vice chair and secretary, respectively. And we went over charges to ourselves and then we divided up the charges that we thought we wanted to attack this year. We get started with the TCAT, one of which was carbon neutrality, was brought up and discussed. And then we discussed more about structure early on.
Any feedback for us or questions for us as a main body? Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Lucelle? Campus Welfare, Mr. McGrath?
Corbett was not able to be here tonight, so I will be reading on his behalf. We had a low attendance on September 23rd meeting and couldn't cover much of the agenda. Those in attendance agreed that the chair would share a list of proposed primary tasks for the CWC and task leaders, and those tasks include to get updates from one of the university diversity officers on work of the Diversity Council since their last visit to UA in 2013, reestablish connection with Gannett Health Service, find out current state of Cornell child care programs and other family support services such as those for spouses, have a conversation with Council on Sexual Violence Prevention Liaison, and follow up on implementation of Resolution 10, Open Access Policy. So those are a couple of different tasks.
Thank you. Coming back to open access policy, which is a little, you know, it's not a square fit in their job jar, but I asked them to take that on behalf of the main body. I was in contact, email contact with the head of that group. They are supposed to give us a report of all the goings on by November. They just had their first meeting a few weeks ago. So they're behind. And we've kind of reached an agreement that we'll check back in January and see if there are any barriers that they're facing that we might be able to weigh in on. And if not, we probably will hear the status in February or March. But at the pace it's going, I don't expect that this is something that's going to resolve, well, any earlier than the end of the year. And it probably is a longer process than that. That's just a preliminary update. Other questions for Mr. McGrath? Thank you. And Codes and Judicial, Professor Wayne.
We met 2 weeks ago. We elected Joseph Friedman as the vice chair. We reviewed the recommendations from the UA for what we should cover. One of those was the limited notice free speech aspect, and Greg Newton was heading up for a task force to cover that report back by October 21st. And we delegated different aspects of the referrals on policy 6.4, making sure that the campus code is updated and from past resolutions and to check on the Lucas Conduct website. And those are just delegated out. And then we elected the members of the University Peer Review Board, which will be on the resolution of the
Thank you. Questions for Professor Wayne? Our deadline for the limited notice, President Horton asked for us to respond back to him by November 1st or 2nd. I know we meet here with him on November 4th, so we will certainly need to give him an update by that meeting. Please let me know if you don't think you'll have something meaningful. I suspect we can't put this to bed. I mean, if there's a resolution, it's going to have to go through the full vetting and everything else. That's at least 6 weeks from the time you've actually agreed on the wording. So I would appreciate after your meeting on the at the end of October an update so that I can set expectations with his office. Anything else for Professor Wayne? Council for Sexual Violence Prevention, Ms. Odessa.
Yes, unfortunately, I don't have anything to report right now. Our first meeting, or my first meeting, will be this Thursday, October 9th. So I'll be happy to report next month.
There, I have seen in the sidewalks kill rapists, you know, painted around or chalked around. I don't know whether that, I don't know what the genesis of that is. I don't know, but hopefully they do, or the groups that are doing that have talked to student assembly or whomever, and whatever's happening is, there's something going on. It's unclear to me what it is. Do you know?
No one has told us.
I saw it painted in at least six different places, so it wasn't like one spot.
Very recent.
Within the past month.
Students definitely know about it and they're talking about it, but we just don't know who...
Or what the agenda is, or whether it's discourse and awareness, or whether there's something else behind it.
There's no official statement of what we said.
Okay. Very good.
There was also like a rally against rape culture that happened last week. They like dropped off mattress and scorched off and stuff like that. And there was a lot of expression of dissatisfaction with bringing it through those avenues that you have mentioned.
So the judicial process may be too slow, may not be forceful enough, maybe, perhaps. Okay. Well, if they're not aware of it, please make them aware of it. I mean, it's obviously very serious, but if it's on folks' mind, we either want to tap into the good energy, increase awareness, and if there's an issue brewing that we don't know about or a problem, we want to find it and see if we can help.
Okay.
Anything else for Ms. Odessa? Policy Advisory Group, Professor Lowe, anything happening there yet? Okay. Excellent. Then we turn to new business. First item up, UA Resolution 1. You mind if I leave my chair? I'll bring it up on the screen while Professor Wayne comes forward to introduce the resolution. Professor Wayne.
UA Resolution 1 is the appointment of University Hearing and University Review Board members for the academic year 2014 and 2015. This will usually have been and will in the future usually be done in the spring, so I'll bring another one to you next spring. These are nominations that were given to us by the faculty, the faculty, and the employees and the students self-nominated, and we read through their applications, we discussed each member, and we voted yay, nay, or maybe, and for discussion. These were the people that we chose to be on the board. Each of them has a couple things that show to them. They're available, and that was important. And the other thing, we asked questions about what would their feelings be about, or their thoughts be, if they were on a hearing board and they disagreed with the rule, with the campus code rule, would they be able to fairly adjudicate the case? Or if there was some procedural errors, how they would handle that. And almost to a person, they each answered in a more than satisfactory way. A very thoughtful, fair.
Anything else you'd like to say?
Since everybody got this, I hope we don't have to read it.
Does anybody want this read for the record, or are you okay with waiving the reading? Hearing no objections, I ask the unanimous consent to waive the reading.
No objections. Reading is waived. Are there any questions, Professor Wayne, for Professor Wayne on the resolution, or any concerns about any of the people named in the resolution?
I do have one question. That is, your numbers for academic year 14 to 15, but some of them pointed to 2 years. Is that going to be up to do this again in the final year of next year? In other words, when I approve this, I'm approving them.
These are the academic year 2014-15 appointments, but if you make the two-year appointments, no, they do not have to be reappointed next year.
Okay, so it's really 14-15 or 14-15.
This appointment is the 2014-15 appointment. Some of them are two-year appointments.
And those are
okay. And so we're
going to... Okay.
Yes, they will be relisted.
Okay.
There could be a reason to perhaps remove somebody for cause, but... not for cause, you will see their names revalidated. Other questions on the resolution? Yes, yes.
Actually, it's a typo. Line 15.
Line 15?
It should be "be it therefore resolved."
Well, we were getting this happen.
Okay, well, this is the PDF version, but without objection. Strike the T, line 15, third letter. Other changes? Hearing none, this has been properly vetted and publicized with the local community. Are we prepared to call the question? Very well, we will vote on UA Resolution 1 as amended, the amendment being striking the letter T from line 15. We'll do the vote by placard. All those in favor of UA Resolution 1, please raise your placard. All those opposed? Abstentions? By a vote of 13-0, Resolution 1 passes. Thank you very much. Our next item of business, we'd like to welcome Dan Roth, the director of the Cornell Sustainability Office, who is here to talk to us, give us an update on all the good things that have happened since last year. Do you want to jump in? Well, I was just going to shake your hand first, but thank you. Welcome, Dan. While I'm getting that up, the floor is yours.
Okay. Can I have much time? Including Q&A?
We set aside 30 minutes to do Q&A.
Sure. So yeah, it's good to see many of you again. So I was here last spring during the divestiture consideration, and I actually updated the University Assembly on a few other things that the university was doing on climate neutrality, and so I'm going to guess.
This one?
Yep. OR. UA is the same as the other. Are you required? Yeah. Oh, that's for after the meeting. So I'm going to review a few things, not knowing how many of you were here at that presentation, but also really the meat of what I'm going to talk about is some of what came out of the Faculty Senate requested a acceleration of the climate neutrality commitment to this committee as well, or this assembly also, and a faculty and administration task team was formed. So I'm going to share some of the outcome of that within the context of our other issues.
If you're comfortable with your own slides, you can do that.
Yeah. So one of the first things I just wanted to kind of put in context is how we're doing nationally in sustainability generally. Three things that you should all be aware of that help us kind of track how we're doing are the national certification system called STARS, which is Sustainability Tracking Assessment Rating System, Sierra Club's annual rankings of the greenest colleges in the country, and the Princeton Review's ranking. And generally, we're doing exceptionally well. Among our peer IVs, we're doing the best, and Sierra Club
ranking. We're kind of back and forth some years in around 10, 11, 12 place. Other years we're 5, 6, 7 place nationally, but we generally stay ahead of our peer group. And so what does that mean exactly? Well, SARS is a comprehensive system that helps us track performance, everything from how many courses are being taught on sustainability, how many faculty are doing research on sustainability, to our greenhouse gases, to our waste reduction, to do we have requirements for students to be engaged with our community, how much actual community service are our students doing, on and on and on. And our SARS score since 2011 when we started has been always going up. So this is kind of the most comprehensive system that we've got to measure our sustainability performance, and we continue to do well. We report annually on SARS, and so the SARS report for 2014 will be out in February. Now then, it's important to understand that Sierra Club and other organizations like Sierra Club and Princeton Review use the SARS data set to then create customized rankings based on weightings that they create for the issues that they care more about or less about depending on the year. And so in the Sierra Club world, we kind of have bounced around a little bit because they've actually changed their rankings year to year and such. So kind of saying that, that in general our sustainability performance is always getting better, even though nationally sometimes depending on the year you might see something of, why didn't we do as well this year in these different rankings? So SARS is really your best place if you ever want to know kind of how we're doing. You can look at several hundred schools and how they're doing and that sort of thing. And the reason why we continue to do well are because from a performance standpoint, we actually are doing very well. Just looking at sustainably sourced food, this is that for sustainably sourced seafood. Our commitment to buying more local food, buying more food that's been certified by third parties as sustainable, is going up very consistently. Our waste reduction efforts have been consistently going and improving. Composting more and more. The big jump is in part due to a few different changes in how we do composting and what is compostable. But our actual landfill amounts continue to go down, even though they're a little bit higher this year. Some of that can be impacted by deconstruction buildings and things like that. So we want to generally see trends going up or down. And the same is true of our carbon footprint. You've probably seen this chart, and even you've seen our presentations of how our carbon inventory is doing. And the big drop, as many of you know, is from going from basically a coal-based system to a natural gas-based system, and going from a predominantly heating-based system where we purchase electricity to producing almost all of our own electricity through the waste heat. Now, we'll probably continue to do very well in all these areas because the President's Sustainable Campus Committee, and there's a huge amount of kind of grassroots support for sustainability on campus. But the President's Sustainable Campus Committee tries to kind of direct that to the teams, the tenth being a people-focused team. And so we'll probably continue to see performance in these different areas. And just a few updates on the people side of sustainability. In terms of student sustainability literacy, this is outside of the formal curriculum. We've got a lot of activity happening, particularly oriented towards freshmen, where almost every event that freshmen go to that serves food during orientation, there's composting and recycling education going on. We have EcoRep in the residence hall on our campus during the school year. We have an annual residential energy competition on North Campus. This year, Susan Murphy supported creating a 5-minute orientation video that's going to be going out this month to all incoming freshmen. So there's a real strong emphasis on freshman engagement. Sustainability is kind of a baseline. But we're also now actually getting data on seniors, and soon we'll be getting data on freshmen's incoming attitudes and behaviors towards sustainability. And on the staff side, many of you may know that Mary Opperman and the HR organization has
updated the skills for success and has included sustainability as an overarching principle of all skills for success for all staff at the university, and has included language that some of you might recognize as kind of triple bottom line language, the final bullet point, under stewardship skills. So even though this is now updated for all staff at the university, it's now just beginning to get rolled into performance management, where this would actually be an expectation that supervisors would expect staff to be able to live up to in their annual performance reviews. So that's just a quick snapshot before we kind of get into more of the specifics of our client neutrality. Because in some ways, we'll come back to these same initiatives. So many of you know that the work of the Carbon Neutrality Acceleration Group was based on the work that came out last year. This is the 2013 Climate Action Plan update. We do an update every 2 years, ever since President Ford has committed to the climate neutrality commitment in 2007. This is the newest update and is available online at climateaction.cornell.edu. The work of the acceleration committee is basically to figure out how to take that 2050 oriented plan, carbon neutrality by 2050, and accelerate that to a 20-year time. Now, how are we doing though? In general, we're doing well. We just launched to help offices across campus certify that they actually are doing best practices in reducing their energy footprint and other initiatives. We've now got 11 offices certified and 4 labs certified. So this is an initiative now to actually take kind of climate neutrality, a very large-scale concept, and help offices and labs across campus actually internalize that commitment through the certification system. The Energy Conservation Initiative, as many of you are aware of, continues to be successful. One of the main indicators of our success is that even though campus has grown in terms of square feet since 2000, the blue bars are actual energy use in our building. So we know that our energy conservation initiatives are successful, but part of acceleration is how do you then take that to the next level. Our efforts to secure renewable energy have been very successful. Has anybody seen our first large-scale solar farm yet?
Okay. We will soon.
Some of you have, but on the 22nd is going to be the first Cornell Solarbration, which will actually have buses going up to the solar farm, and we'll have hopefully the president of NYSERDA there as we kind of to the grand opening for Cornell's first solar farm. And if you've been watching the news closely, you might have heard the NYSERDA announcement that we've received NYSERDA's fund for 2 megawatts or 8 more megawatts of solar farms to be built on Cornell land. And as many of you also know, we're in negotiation with the power purchase group for wind power.
I'm sorry, Dan, you said that's been approved?
NYSERDA, as of 2 weeks ago, put out a press release that the statewide funding pool that Cornell had applied to for 8 more megawatts of solar was approved.
Awesome.
So our efforts to secure renewable energy are well underway, and really what's needed to figure out if we can get to climate neutrality in 15 years sooner is kind of building on that work. But some very specific initiatives that the faculty staff committee came up with to come to this kind of future. So, in brief, this group met over a 3-week, roughly 3-month period based on President Scorton's request. And they, as I said, kind of used the background that I just talked to you about as the basis, but then how do you accelerate that effort? And the conclusion they came to was that setting a new climate neutrality goal was both imperative and possible. So this actually was not a given. It's not an easy task. It was not, it's not just a given that they would have said yes. So they determined that, but they outlined kind of 3 principles that would have to be agreed upon by the university as a whole, that there would need to be a very clear commitment, not just from the president, but a university-wide commitment. Up till now, most of the commitment has been made by the president. The board of trustees has endorsed that commitment, but there's not been necessarily a university-wide fully embraced commitment to climate neutrality. I don't mean to say that there's some enemies of climate neutrality out there. It's just it was never brought to the full campus to support. So I think some of the resolutions that have been passed by the faculty senate and your group kind of show that university-wide commitment is there. But we need to perhaps just kind of formalize that. So we need to integrate the climate action plan more deeply into the academic mission of the university. Many people saw the climate action plan and our neutrality commitment as an operational initiative. And this needs to be really seen as core to the research we do, core to the education, and the experience we create for our students, and the public engagement work that the university does. We won't achieve our goals if we just see that as an operational initiative that facilities services or other operational groups bear or take on. And then we're going to need to much more actively go after fundraising and external partnerships to succeed in getting some of the more novel approaches that we want to try off the ground. We won't be able to just do this on kind of single bottom line return on investment as we have, for example, with energy conservation or some of these renewable energy projects we're doing right now that take no capital from Cornell because we're getting into partnerships with a for-profit entity. They're taking on most of the risk. So we're not going to be able to always be able to bank on those kinds of activities to get us to those dollars. Now, they identified there are some very clear benefits to Cornell if we take an even further, more aggressive leadership position on climate neutrality. As many of you know, there's heightened awareness of these issues, you know, from the UN to the U.S. federal government to grassroots communities to students on our campuses. So we think, or this committee that I was on, thinks that it's actually a very advantageous position for Cornell to take to be an even more aggressive leader on climate issues. That there's a chance to motivate alumni who maybe in the past have not been as motivated to engage with the university. This is perhaps an area for new research partnerships with external both federal government agencies and the private sector. There's vast experiential learning opportunities for students. I think the commitment that was just announced this past week to engage Cornell is a perfect example where climate neutrality should not be seen as kind of a separate thing off on the side, but climate neutrality and our achievement of this climate leadership role should be integral to part of our public engagement. And of course, there's going to be continued energy savings, cost savings, when we do more conservation and reduce demand. They got much more specific, so I'm going to go through the six milestones that they came to that really they thought as critical to showing this leadership position and not just saying we're going to accelerate our climate neutrality commitment, but not actually change how we do business. So they outlined six key milestones. The first milestone was to launch a much more aggressive, much more wide-reaching campaign that would need to have academic and operational partners and would look probably more like toward your destinations, for example, than the way that we've often been promoting climate neutrality to date, which is kind of more voluntary and kind of trying to build a community around an issue as opposed to seeing it as an imperative that colleges and units need to commit to and have to set goals within their own units and organizations. And then we need to be looking at our curriculum and the research that we do much more proactively than we had in the past with our climate action plan. Again, partially because we saw this mostly institutionally as a facilities operational effort and not a mission critical organizational. They also outlined two very specific areas where we think we need to grow and build on our energy conservation initiative. This would probably require Board of Trustees approval, similar to the policy we passed back in 2006
that all new construction has to be LEED Silver certified. It has to be 30% more energy efficient than our national code for buildings of these types. That was a Board of Trustees action. Similar action would probably be taken for these 2 points, that we would actually have to set even higher energy standards. Currently, we're at 30% above the kind of status quo national average. The working model is that we would need to set that at around 50% more high-performance buildings for all new construction. And that would have very real consequences to how deans make decisions about their upfront costs for new buildings versus long-term operating costs. So there's real fiscal kind of organizational impact of setting higher energy performance standards. But we could see 30 to 50% energy savings if we actually did that. So these don't have benefits, they just change how we have to make decisions. We would also likely need to extend the payback period that we currently use for energy conservation decisions. So currently, we basically use a 7-year payback period. If something in a building, doing a retrofit on an existing building, will take more than 7 years to pay itself back, we don't do it. We don't create that kind of financial risk, you might call it. We need to probably move that out to 14 to 15 years to actually do the amount of energy conservation work that most of you probably would identify as low-hanging fruit. You know, oh, well, why is all this hot air pouring out of this building during certain times of the year? Why don't they recapture some of that heat? Why don't we have LED lights all over campus, for example, when that's the most up-to-date technology? So for a lot of those kinds of things, we would have to extend our internal payback period that we allow ourselves to be able to do energy conservation for us. So these two are very specific things that the university would have to take on. Kind of shifting a little bit, but also in the area of kind of demand reduction. How do we actually get people to reduce their use of energy? Not so much from the technical standpoint, the way I was just describing it, in terms of how we build buildings or retrofit buildings, but how do we actually get people in their decisions to change their behavior? So one of the ways you can do that is create disincentives for doing things that are carbon intensive. So one of the ways to do that is create carbon fees that disincentivize things, just like we create parking fees to disincentivize parking when we want to encourage more sustainable modes of transportation. So two of the areas that we know are the most carbon intensive are travel. When we actually do business travel and we go to campus and leave campus commuting, or when we fly to conferences and things like that, and the energy we demand for our buildings, that is the utilities that we demand for heating and for cooling and electricity. So a step forward would be to institutionalize some sort of carbon fee that would disincentivize the behaviors we know are carbon intensive, and also create some funding mechanisms that can support our mission as an institution. That literally create funding pools for us to do things we want to do as an institution. It could be public engagement, it could be internal research, it could be student learning opportunities. So you'd have a dual purpose effect of a carbon fee, of carbon fees on behavior and resource availability. Continuing to build on the work of securing renewable energy will be more increasingly challenging. Part of that is because renewable energy takes space. And space is not, Cornell owns lots of land, but a lot of that land is up against other landowners, or there's various uses for that land. So solar farms take up lots of square footage. Wind farms have a huge view shed and are much more intensive industrial equipment. So biomass, for example, is another area that we've looked into. Would require harvesting sustainable forest products or sustainable crops that we can grow. All of these things take substantial land resources. So we know that power purchase agreements are possible in terms of doing this for essentially no upfront capital for Cornell, but the land issues that we have to be able to wrestle with are very real. So these PPAs are a good model, but will not necessarily just be a done deal that we'll just sign on. Maybe the biggest renewable energy project that we need to wrestle with as an institution has been part of the plan since 2007, but we haven't committed substantial resources to deep geothermal heating. This concept has been on the table since 2007. We've vetted it through community research. It seems very acceptable to our regional community. It seems very interesting to one of our researchers. A lot of people that we talk to on campus seem excited about this opportunity, but we have to turn that excitement into dollars. We need to turn that excitement into real technical feasibility studies that would cost in the range of $3 million to simply identify, is this indeed a long-term, viable, reliable solution for Cornell's heating requirements? Otherwise, we need to take this off the table and look at other options such as biomass or even more novel things if we haven't really fully said yet. So even to fully wrestle with this, we need to allocate about $3 million as an institution to go further along the geothermal route. Now, all of those actions on campus won't be possible if there isn't a significant acceleration or a significant increase in our engagement of external partners, alumni, funders, and so some sort of large-scale themes, climate action or climate neutrality-related fundraising and engagement campaigns need to be launched. We need to integrate with the faculty renewal processes that we're going to be fundraising for. We need to be integrated into infrastructure renewal that we need to be doing. So this isn't a whole separate fundraising initiative. This would be something that's a themed campaign integrated with our other needs. And we would need to appoint somebody in alumni development somewhere appropriate that can help lead the partnership work to actually bring those external partnerships to bear. So those were the six milestones that the committee laid out, and just want to give you a heads up on kind of what's next. And I'm wondering, so gave President Sorkin this report, and this report was presented back to the faculty senate. Several of the leaders from the different assemblies have seen the presentation. But what's next? So the Board of Trustees is going to have a presentation on some of these topics at the TCAN weekend. There's been some conversation about a campus forum of some sort to create more dialogue on campus about the repercussions of a more grand position on this. There's the Green Office and Green Lab certification system, which in fact is one way that this kind of can trickle down to our campus community more broadly. So how we promote that is actually one very clear next step. There's, as I mentioned, there's never really been a commitment made by any of the deans, by any of the units of the university. Anything's been made by the president. And many of the decisions and the changes would actually be at that level of our institution, not only at the presidential level. So faculty and students that have expressed support for this are looking at ways that they can engage their colleges and units. And from those six milestones and several of the kind of sub-topics underneath those, our office and members of the President's Sustainable Campus Committee are going to be working to create working groups on those initiatives to kind of go deeper in this. Because as I said, this is only a three-month window of time that the faculty and staff working groups work on this. So there's a lot of financial scenarios that need to get more details. Those would be done in the working groups. So we'd actually be kicking off, if any of you are interested, on November 17th, November 18th, at the annual President's Sustainable Campus Committee Summit. We're going to make sure to invite the UA this year. I don't think we've done that in the past. And we're going to be kicking off those formations of that working groups. So that's the kind of update on the kind of broad sustainability and where we're at with this acceleration working group. And is it indeed that I have 5 minutes now for
this? Yes.
Yeah? Oh, I don't know. This thing says 25 minutes, so I don't know.
Don't worry about that.
Don't worry about that. I'm happy to take questions.
Questions for Mr. Roth. Professor Wayne.
What's the cross library project? The cross library project was a
refurbishing. It was kind of they pretty much totally redid the heating and cooling system, and so they were able to do a lot more heat recovery in the building, and also were able to keep the moisture level much more consistent for long-term preservation. So it was basically a heating and cooling retrofit.
Mr. Battaglia?
Just out of curiosity, I want your personal opinion. Last year, this body passed a resolution asking that the university move its carbon neutrality to 2035, which President Skorton accepted. Do you personally think we're on track to meet that goal, and do you think it's something we can do, or do you think it's something that we are saying but not really can back it up?
Do I personally think we can achieve carbon neutrality by 2035, or do I think we can...
Do you think right now we're on the track to do so?
I think my personal opinion is that we're paving, new ground, and I think the transition to a new president has made that challenging in terms of, how quickly we can actually move on the recommendations that came out of this faculty working group. I think maybe the simplest way to answer your question is I think achieving climate neutrality by 2035 is absolutely impossible. The whole entire University of California system set a goal of, I think, 2020 to 2025 to achieve climate neutrality, and I actually think they can achieve that goal. I think a lot of this, what it really comes down to, is how willing are you institutionally to change how you do business, and how quickly do you incorporate essentially some of these global challenges into your core business operations? Or how much do you kind of keep it as a kind of, I wouldn't call it marginal, but how do you kind of keep it as a one of many kind of competing priorities versus how much do you really integrate it into your core business? And I think the commitment we've recently this week on Engage Cornell is a very good example of, what we're saying is we want this to be core to how we do business at the institution. Because of that, we're willing to put it in, engage in our alumni and our partners $150 million of a scale of this. If we're willing to do that for climate neutrality, I think we could very well achieve our goal.
Professor Hatch.
So this is the next step. Congratulations. I'm going to take a lot of energy, a lot of time, a lot of money. So what I'm wondering is, what's so important about changing from 2035 to 2035 to 2020? What's the overriding goal? This is a two-part question.
Okay.
Can you answer, why do we need to?
Why does it matter to change that?
Why do we need carbon neutrality, and why are we advancing? I'm asking you the two-part question.
Two-part question.
That's the first.
I think it's university's responsibility as leaders in research, education, and in public engagement, particularly for land-grant schools, to be the most aggressive on carbon reduction and solutions that actually can change the economic marketplace, the social marketplace.
Okay, but so the reason why we're doing that research, we're proving so forth, is something else. What's the ultimate?
I know you're serious, but that's a very long conversation about why we need to reduce carbon emissions.
Let's say it's the loss of the ice cap. It's the loss. In other words, we need to do it because the Earth is declining. Yeah.
The way I look at it personally is I think of it as primarily as human social justice issue. That the polar ice caps can melt, certain people in the world will not suffer as much as other people will. And what will begin to happen very quickly, and is already happening, is communities in parts of the world that have low, sea level and do not have the resources to adapt will be the most dramatically affected. And that's going to be true within our own country, in terms of if you look at the flooding and food, the communities that are most
affected.
So I don't get it as fundamentally as a social justice issue, that we are failing
parts of humanity will bear the impact of climate change.
But in the end, we're failing ourselves because we're involved at the end of this all. I mean, it's not just them that's going to affect it. It's us. It's the decline in resources. It's the decline in readability. It's the decline in lots of things.
I recommend that anybody if you're interested in that particular topic, there's a report by Bloomberg and Paulson, Henry Paulson, our past Treasury Secretary, called Risky Business. It outlines the billions of dollars of economic loss that will result in.
So I guess what I'm getting at in all of this is, what's the alternative? What's the debate about it? If this is an issue of, oh, let's, you know, I'll go all out saving the planet, and there's no future if we're going to save the planet for us or our children or our grandchildren.
I think there are debates then is about how proactive we want to be supposed to be. That at a certain point, there will probably very likely be carbon taxes imposed on universities and any large businesses, and then we'll be in a reactive position. There'll be more and more pressure for the university to take a reaction, a response to things that will become more drastic and dramatic, and then we'll be in a reactive situation. So really it's a matter, in my thought, of do we want to be proactive, and do we want to help lead, of course, towards a more responsible position on this issue? Or are we going to allow other universities to be in that leadership role and be in a more reactive position? And that is a challenging thing because it's really about how do we use our limited resources as an institution. And there's many other ways of looking at those critical issues, you know, global health, equity, all sorts of ecological issues that some may say are equally as important. But it's positive. It's really just about we want to be proactive or reactive. Your first question of what's 2050 versus 2035, similarly, do we want to be in a leadership position? Do we want to play that role in a society that's trying to deal with these issues? And I also think it makes it much more real in terms of 20 years and sometimes the time frame that people in this room can probably imagine reasonably staying involved in Cornell and life in this area. 35 years starts to get outside of people's kind of time frame of decision making. So I think there's a very real reason, very tangible reason why to accelerate to a time frame that is seen as kind of manageable within our current decision making horizon.
Thank you. Mr. Musi?
So one of the questions I had was around the carbon use, the paying for carbon usage, and sort of the idea that fee would go into a general fund. Is there any sort of consideration that fee would go back to whoever paid that for initiatives to help them reduce their own individual rather than sort of just being a university tax?
Absolutely. I mean, that's essentially what happens in most cases. So with the parking fees, that's going into a budget, then transportation uses to try to offer all sorts of alternatives. New York State has a tax on every electron that you buy for your home, and that's going into NYSERDA's budget. NYSERDA uses that to incentivize renewable energy production, energy conservation in your homes. So I think there are very comparable systems in place that basically seek to benefit the people who are paying into that system, but that it changes where the incentives and disincentives are so that we get the kind of behavior that is less carbon intensive. So yeah, I mean, I would see it as kind of a cycle where there's a clear benefit back to the payers, but would change how we incentivize and disincentivize.
But that would be a more of a sort of a global view rather than a sort of being, you know, if I'm building A and I'm paying a tax or unit A, that I would have sort of a deferred saving, you know, to impact my specific environment.
Yes. We're now speculating. So if there was some sort of utility-based carbon fee that colleges were paying into because they're paying all these bills, and then that money was used to help the colleges do energy conservation work, they could potentially actually reduce their actual bill even below what the increase you saw from the fee was, then
I'm just wondering if it's going into a general fund or if it would be, if it's proposed to be more specific use for the individual payer.
That's exactly the kind of detail
Thank you. Ms. Barnett.
So to date, our climate neutrality commitment has only covered the other campuses. At the moment, the task of just getting the other campus towards this goal has been enough. So our office, for example, and the President of the Sustainable Campus Committee was only set up for the other campus. I do know that Lyle and Geneva and the efforts at Cornell Tech in New York City, there's sustainability initiatives happening in all of those places, including trying to build a net zero energy building on North Island. But in terms of the scope of the commitments we've made, the scope does not include that. And people have been interested in expanding that, but I think we're having a hard enough time wrestling with just the open campus. But personally, I don't think that's wise yet.
Thank you. BJ?
So my experience here working with peer companies and things like that is trying to pass six milestones doing six initiatives, like trying to tie campus. So if we were to focus all our efforts into one thing that we could accomplish in a New Year's session, which one of those things we outlined has the most impact that can move us forward?
Kind of depends on the personality of your assembly. I mentioned a few policy initiatives. If the assembly is very interested in very specific policy things, there are some very specific policies that could dramatically change the needle. I think the milestone number one is number one from the committee, the Acceleration Working Group committee point of view, because it is probably the most important, which is to really, because this goes to the point of integrating the climate action plan into our academic core mission. So to not see it as something that's going to happen on the fringe of Cornell's kind of activity, but really is core to the curriculum that we teach, is core to the research and the faculty that we hire, is core to how we do business as an organization. And to do that is going to take a level of activity that is in itself very substantial. To do anything like a token destination type of work at the decision-making level is quite challenging. To actually change curriculum is itself also very challenging. To influence how faculty, the themes the faculty are hired around, these are all activities that require a lot of buy-in. And so if I was going to customize an ask to the university assembly, this might be an area that you're best suited to work on, in the sense that you represent any of the different constituencies that have to be involved.
We're just about out of time. I think two questions. Mr. Walrus?
Yeah, so I have a question going back, two questions actually. First question going back to those carbon fees. How would those actually be assessed? Would that be at a college level, at a department level, at an individual lab level? Or how do you see those?
So currently, the two types of fees that were proposed were the utility-based fee and the travel-based fee. So the utility-based fee would most logically be who's paying them already. And in many cases, that's at the college level. But they have metering of building. So a college can actually see how much its buildings are using, but it's the bill is getting paid at the college level. So the utility-based carbon fee would be at that level. The travel fee is a little bit trickier, because currently there's several players involved in travel reimbursement. There's the individual who often pays out, when they travel. So one place could be to put a travel fee at that moment, and then they get reimbursed for the payout of that fee. Or we could aggregate lots of travelers and all of their decisions. Unfortunate side of that is that you don't actually get the effect of the traveler who can make a choice of how they travel or don't travel, or do they, think about the carbon impact of their travel when they travel, which is part of the behavior change impact you want. If you remove that and centralize it and aggregate lots of travelers together, the traveler will have no idea. They'll just travel, they won't be thinking about the carbon impact, there'll be no behavior change benefit. So there might be a simplicity from a bureaucratic standpoint, but a loss of the behavior change
impact that you might want to put into the user.
Very briefly, if I can wrap this up with a final question from myself. So, as you know, you were there, the leadership breakfast. As we noted in here, President Scorton accepted the idea of moving carbon neutrality to 2035, but as I heard Bert Land talk about it, he hasn't accepted that yet. They formed this committee. It says it's possible. The six things need to happen first. And so you would still say, am I correct, that the carbon neutrality goal of Cornell is still 2050 and we're looking at accelerating it?
Yes.
So what I want to make clear to this assembly is 2035 is not the new goal based on all the accepted resolutions last year. And this is what Mr. Battaglia was mentioning, something we want to discuss with President Scorton. I think what's really happening makes sense, but there has not been a sign-on of 2035. They're looking seriously at how forward we can bring it, but they have not signed on officially to 2035 as a new restated Cornell goal. Finally, the six resolutions or milestones, do they each have somebody assigned shepherding them through, or is this sitting in front of the President's Commission and we're waiting for them to tell us what's next?
So I think the point of setting the goals, we are in a position where
if I can interrupt, and this isn't to be adversarial, if there's people responsible for the milestones,
yeah,
we would want to hear from them where they think their milestone is and what their barriers are to moving it forward so that we can hold somebody accountable this year to making progress without not trying to be too threatening or confrontational. And we will have President Scorton here on November 4th, so I'd be interested if offline you could, if I could get your presentation or certainly the milestones and a sense of whose buttons do we need to press, President Scorton's or others, to ensure that they're meeting the trustees. The trustees are going to get a presentation. Wonderful. Is anybody asking them to decide anything at this upcoming presentation, or are we just updating it?
No. It's not a seeking for approval. And I mentioned the working group's being formed, and we're going to be taking that off on November 18th. So really all that we've been doing now is kind of trying to gauge who are the right players that would be involved in advancing the milestone. So there's nobody yet who's agreed to take a lead on any particular milestones.
Thank you. Okay. We look forward to helping you in where we can. We don't want to do things that actually slow things down. At the same time, this is hard. It will take some pressure to ensure things get done. And we would like to be vectored in the appropriate way to help chip away and make this a reality. Thank you so much, very much, for joining us. We really appreciate your time. Thank you. Round of applause.
Before we have the employee of the month, I'd like to
thank you. I'm sure that there's some people here who will continue on this conversation. Next up on our agenda, and we'll probably abbreviate the time a little bit, is something that President Scorton asked us to take up in the newspaper. Not bad. A discussion on civilian. The article is before you. I did send it to you in advance, but I don't know that anyone here has read it. My short summary is there is renewed activism on campus. That's a good thing. We like our campus to be engaged in issues and pressing and making sure that we're working on these things. At the same time, he believes that there's the solution is more dialogue, not shouting each other down, perhaps, an oversimplification, but actually more dialogue in some of these controversial issues. And he talks about the campus code and reasonable time, place, and manner restrictions, which is a definite link to some of the things that the CJC has been asked to look at later this year, and a task force that is still not quite formed to look into how we might bring in to some level of configuration control the various open space rules and stuff so that they're appropriate. But he calls at the end of his op-ed,
call on our shared governance groups to talk about these issues and help us live collectively in ways that promote constructive dialogue and foster greater understanding. So my question to you before the meeting, and I don't know how much intellectual capital you put on this, hopefully some, how can we do that? How do we do that? How do we hear some very emotional and sustainability issues and whether the endowment or not, Middle East, how do we keep that civil and at the appropriate level of discourse? And of course, if this was easy, we'd all know the answer, right? So does anybody have some thoughts how we, as a body, need to adopt policies, or do you think that we inherently, generally do this as good as a human process can do it? Sir?
I think to tie this to the goal number one, I guess, was that is it to make camps aware of the whatever, you know, of something to do with why we're thinking at all about sustainability and carbon neutrality, and why we're thinking at all is important to come to 2050 and 2035. And, you know, Dan started to talk about that, but the thing that always comes to my mind, and this is the debate we're saying about this, is in dialogue there needs to be a deeper penetration of motive and behavior than very often people allow. What I was trying to get in my question to him was, why is it that it takes so long? If we are all, you know, on the Titanic, and we know it's going to, you know, hit an iceberg, and we're all going to, most of us are going to die, and, our parts are going to break by, but, you know, the stars get people who are in low-lying areas. New York City's in a low-lying area. But anyway, then why is it that we are sitting around talking about, you know, carbon taxing on departments? Why is it the trustees need to hear convincing arguments about why they should spend $3 million to find out if we can increase carbon emissions by a certain amount? Why isn't it just right there, if that's the question? So I was asking the question about what's the counter-argument that it's not going to happen? What's the counter-argument that, you know, that there's not going to be the greenhouse gas, you know, pollution? Well, of course, that is an argument that's around in society. But is it here? Will more research, a better informed campus, help us get to the point that everybody really believes it and knows that it's really important to do something?
So talking about what you're just saying, I think the issue, so like, why is $3 million an issue? Because, as the last budget shows, we were about, in a posterior last comment I heard, I think in the University Assembly, we were about $200,000 in the black. Not $3 million, but $200,000. So if we make a $3 million commitment, what do we give up?
Yes, exactly. So I understand, what do we give up if we don't? And what we give up if we don't is that progress for this small, tiny corner of the universe, you know, albeit one that has certain proportions in the amount of power, because it is a research university, and we have young people that we're trying to teach about what's going to be important in their lives based upon our research and based upon, you know, what we see around us. So I'm saying, why is it that we would drag our feet on it? When, why isn't there more?
Well, I understand that somebody
from another point of view saying, well, there isn't more because it's not true. Because it's never going to happen.
Well, I mean, so a lot of, as you know, science does agree, and this is off topic, so I want to come back to order. But fundamentally, there are different ways to gauge behavior. Should we close down the synchrotron?
there's a 20%, I don't have a number that I can't back up, but you know, it's a high power output. How do you gauge that science versus that quick solution? So I don't want to turn this into carbon neutrality. The question here is civil dialogue, but questions like that are on point. This means
I think for the assembly structure, how do we promote constructive action? Because I think here especially at times we can do a lot of talking, and I think that's one of the reasons why we drag our feet on a $3 million purchase is because we've got to march it to every corner and every place, rather than those that are entrusted to make the decisions based on the system that's been established to create action and to move forward and to advance progress. Because really, I feel we're constantly in a state of dialogue, whether it be deep or not. That's a different debate. But I think the conversation we should be having is how can we actually have constructive action across the assemblies? And you know, it doesn't have to necessarily be unified or fixed, but in a way that even if we're going at it from different angles, we're still progressing a similar shared action items. And I know it's hard to create action because of the system we have, but I think that's really the discussion as opposed to dialogue.
Hopefully dialogue leads to constructive action, not always, but some. And you know, I come, for those of you who don't know, just shy of 24 years in the U.S. military. We never took this long to make many of our decisions. But that's not always a strength. And in the university environment, vetting is done a different way. You have to work in the culture you have.
But should the vetting be done here, or should the vetting be done based on the folks that dedicate their lives to research? And I mean, is that where the dialogue takes place in the classroom, and should more of the action take place at the assembly level?
Obviously, issue specific. I look at us as a counterbalance. You know, if everything is working perfectly in the university, we have very little to do. It's when people don't quite see, either they don't understand or don't quite see the dialogue, or think it's misplaced or not, or there's some concern, where can they bring it to get focus on it and in a constructive way engage in an oversight way, also to pat them on the back when they get it right. But if everybody loved every decision, we probably wouldn't have a job, in at least in many senses. It's a human process. This one has evolved to what it is. It probably, over time, we need to adapt to future courses. But coming kind of back to order on civility, we can publish a resolution in support of. We can increase dialogue between the assemblies. We have not this year yet, had a contentious issue in this room, but we have, many of us last year have seen a few. And the student assembly is usually the leader in this, so we will dutifully defer to Ms. Malik on how to discharge the situation and hopefully move it forward constructively. But ultimately, reasonable minds differ on what should happen, and the people at the point of impact may not ever agree on. So how do people who are interested want to do what's in the best interest of Cornell help this process? If the situation will allow themselves to be helped. I don't have a pat answer to this. I want to, though, be able to make sure we think about it, because I guarantee you before this year is over, there will be at least one. There is always one every year. Last year, I think we had essentially four, or 3.5. There's usually one or two that hits the threshold. And that's not a bad thing. That's a good thing. The key, though, is to make sure that the dialogue is civil, that we get both sides, in my opinion, part of the answer is getting the full story, so that people who are not so close to the issue can make a reasonable decision for the good of Cornell. And, time will tell, history will somewhat tell whether we get it mostly right or not. Congrats.
Just kind of spit the line. I think it's important that the activist groups have dialogue, whereas I think a lot of times it doesn't reach dialogue, it reaches shouting matches and hope plaza. And so that isn't really under the definition of dialogue. So in approaching possible problems for the upcoming year, possibly having a platform that fosters civil dialogue. And just, you know, I personally didn't know the value of dialogue until being on this board and understanding how impactful it can be, and having opposing sides bring up their topics. And if we were able to implement that in the activist groups, whereas I don't feel like that platform is there, where you reach a shouting match in Whole Plaza or through other avenues, then I feel like it would be civil, it would be dialogue. So possibly like a panel with a mediator with two opposing groups that can go to a university sponsored event or something where they can have
certainly
dialogue.
You try and head to those processes, but people who are protesting and shouting, sometimes that tactic is what they feel they need to draw attention, focus, and willpower to do action. And as much as they may or may not think these that we move fast enough, quick enough on important issues, so they themselves have a calculus. Mr. Meese?
I think one of the things is I wish that there was engagement earlier on in discourse rather than discourse at the end, or what by the system has created sort of the last point, that if we had the discourse earlier on in an engaging way, and I think trying to find ways to invite to the discourse before there's a decision to be made is where we fall short.
Yes. Okay, I'm sorry. Let me not express agreement. What I would tell you is we wait for somebody to introduce a resolution versus inviting people who are in the Daily Sun to come talk to us before things have blown up. It's definitely
a
body like this could go more seeking for those issues than we currently do. That is possible. Sir?
Remember what we're supposed to do here. First of all, our input is by the campus code, which is ours.
Yes.
I've read in the Sun this two or three times, and to tell you the truth, who's going to be against it? Let's all be civil. We could make a resolution right now. The university has to resolve that everyone should just be civil.
I mean, that's what
we're
right?
supposed to do.
No.
I don't think that's what the Art University Assembly job is for. We have the campus code. It tends to be more reactive than I might like if you wait for somebody to do this, like the NCAA. You wait for someone to break the rule and then you find some way to come up with a law to prevent it. I think there are ways that you could foster dialogue, which we have done in the past by having open forums and things like that. But in terms of the present thing, I hope the University Assembly will do something more to foster stability. I'm not sure how you do that. Besides, you know, we're going to get two groups together and, you know, they can think it out. I think our real power is in what we do with the campus code. Because that's the only thing we really have within our purview that addresses these kinds of issues. The rest are things that, you know, people of goodwill get together. You don't need this assembly to do it.
That's
so
true.
I was a bit
not
concerned that he was simply making statements that he felt he had to make and, you know, point in various directions. But I think we're pretty much what we can do.
Okay.
But that's just my opinion.
Let me bring this issue to close. May I have a motion to extend the meeting for 5 minutes? Is there any dissent? All right. Let me bring this issue to a close. If you have something you think that we should do as a body, an action piece, please email the UA exec or call us. You can also write to all the members if you think it's something you want everybody's engagement on. And I want you to keep it in the forward part of your brain as we move through the year. Ma'am?
I just wanted to make a suggestion that there is a really interesting student response to what President Sport wrote in the Sun today, and if no one's here to have a chance to read it yet, I think that they should. And I think that in the future, a lot of this is going to be opening the dialogue on the terms of other people and not necessarily in the terms of how to establish people.
Thank you.
Can you just kind of wrap?
Yeah, I can.
Could you send the link? I heard about it just before this meeting, and I would very much like to read it.
I definitely.
The final agenda was the additional, the late addition to the agenda. We're not going to really have time to go through this. I'm going to send you Resolution 2, which is essentially a welcome to Elizabeth Garrett to Cornell, inviting her to participate in campus governance, asking her to include us in her transition plans and meet with us either individually or collectively as that works out, and certainly inviting her to be an active participant as President Scorton is on a recurring basis and inviting us for meetings. I listed the sponsors as the chairs and presidents of the various groups. They've seen a version of this. In general, they're okay with the wording, but I'll firm that up and I'll put this on as a firm resolution for next time. It can wait till the next meeting because Professor Garrett won't be really transitioning before January. She's not going to all of a sudden come next month because we don't get this passed this month, or if she was, it wouldn't be because we passed it. So we have time to work this. It's not a resolution that needs public advertising. It's really an extension and an invitation on our behalf to President Garrett, so President-elect Garrett. So we will put it out publicly, but this is not one that requires 30-day posting and public comment kind of thing. Is there anything else we need to discuss in the last minute?
Motion to adjourn.
A reminder, President Scorton is next time. I will be canvassing you by email. Hearing nothing else and without objection, we are adjourned. Thank you for coming.
This has been a production of Cornell University. On the web at cornell.edu.